Welcome to the Excellence in Church Administration podcast, informing, encouraging, and supporting your church. Your hosts are Michael Martin and Dan Busby from ECFA.
Welcome to the podcast, everyone. This is Dan Busby, and I'm joined once again by my co-host for this podcast, Michael Martin.
Hey, Dan, it's great to be with you as always.
So we're here today to cover a topic that's relevant all year long, but it's especially on the minds of church leaders around and just after year end, and that is charitable gift acknowledgments. While at a first glance, this may seem like a very dry and technical topic or something our listeners might feel like they've already mastered, there's more to it than that. Right, Michael?
That's right. We would never pick a dry and technical topic for our listeners, would we?
No.
No. Hey, this is such an important topic, and really it involves a whole host of legal, tax, accounting, and ethical issues, so all of our favorites. The good news is here, the rules don't change on us very often, and really the more we review them and institute those appropriate policies, the more comfortable that we can become with them. But on the other hand, the bad news is that the tax laws are very strict and unforgiving in this area. So even really a minor violation of these gift substantiation rules can jeopardize a giver's tax deduction to the church.
Yes, and we see cases reported on a regular basis from the tax court involving givers who lose out on hundreds or even thousands of dollars in tax deductions because a church or charity fails to meet the requirements imposed by the law. So let's talk more about some of those specific requirements in a minute. But Michael, in a recent ECFA webinar, you mentioned a tax court case involving a church where the giver was denied a charitable contribution deduction for failure to provide adequate substantiation when under audit. But this was no ordinary case, was it?
No, that's right, Dan. As you shared, it's not unusual really for us to see these types of disputes come up involving the IRS denying givers those deductions for somehow failing to provide the necessary charitable gift substantiation. And in many cases, really, it's troubles that are caused by the organization that's receiving the gift in failing to provide proper substantiation. But what's different about this case and why we highlighted it is because it's not every day that these cases involve a giver who just happened to be an accountant, a tax preparer, and a financial consultant to churches, like the Barnes versus Commissioner case that was just reported by the tax court in late 2016. So, Dan, unfortunately, in this case, we had an individual, someone that we might assume would have a great deal of knowledge and experience in an area like this, who wound up losing several thousands of dollars again in charitable deductions for contributions that weren't properly acknowledged and ended up in tax court in part over these very issues. You know, I personally, I think it's a very interesting case. It illustrates some of the most important concepts in this area and serves as a good reminder, as you mentioned, Dan, even for folks who've worked around nonprofits for years and might be familiar with the rules in this area, the important lesson is we should not overlook the basics, right?
Yes, Michael, that's a great illustration. Although we can't cover all the ins and outs for charitable gift substantiation in this short podcast, we've put together what we call a top list of the seven deadly sins of gift acknowledgments. And the reason we call them deadly is because even one minor failure to follow the strict gift substantiation rules could mean the loss of hundreds or thousands of dollars in tax deductions for your givers, as we saw in the Barnes case you mentioned. So how about if we get started with sin number one?
All right. Well, that's a good place to start. Number one, we say that sin number one is really failing to receipt the right kinds of gifts. And this is important to remember, single contributions of $250 or more. That's really the first and foremost, the obvious sin to avoid, failing to provide givers with a proper receipt when one is needed. Can't get more basic than that. So, you know, many folks might be saying, all right, well, when is that the case? Tax law is what sets the bar for us at single contributions of $250 or more. Gifts below that amount don't require a receipt unless they're gifts of currency, right? So those are like our bills and coins that have no other form of substantiation. We get asked this often. One annual summary of all gifts made throughout the year is sufficient, so long as it lists the gifts by date and amount, making contributions of $250 or more really identifiable within that total. And just a note, keep in mind that the $250 threshold applies to both monetary gifts and non-monetary gifts, which are also synonymous as, you know, gifts of property.
Yes, and for sin number two, we say receiving the wrong kind of gifts. Time and rent-free use of property are examples. Churches are often blessed by those who generously give their time or use of their property to the church. And while these gifts are often extremely valuable, they cannot be claimed by the giver as deductible contributions for tax purposes. Churches should never, and we don't often use the word never, Michael, but churches should never provide receipts to givers for their time or use of their property. But they may provide a letter at year end thanking volunteers for their time and or use of property and advising them that unreimbursed out-of-pocket expenses related to their volunteer service may be deductible.
Right. And that could be an extremely important benefit. I know for a lot of the super volunteers that we have at our churches that may be incurring a lot of those unreimbursed expenses. Let's go into sin number three, and that is receiving the wrong person. And by that, we mean a taxpayer other than the giver. I know we're familiar with this scenario. Churches are sometimes asked to provide a gift receipt in the name of someone other than the giver. And we say to avoid being complicit in tax fraud, it generally is only appropriate to issue a gift receipt to the taxpayer who's actually remitting the funds or the property, or in other words, the source of the funds. Right.
Absolutely. And sin number four is a biggie: missing the correct IRS wording. And that the wording often relates to the phrase no goods or services. And here's why this is so bad. Even if your church provides a receipt for the right kinds of gifts to the right person, it still must have some very specific information and wording to be sufficient for substantiation purposes. So churches should be sure that their gift receipts are in writing and include the following. First, your church's name and the giver's name. Secondly, the date the donation was made and a date the receipt was issued. Number three, the amount of cash or description of the property contributed. And finally, number four, a statement explaining whether the church provided any goods or services to the giver in exchange for the contribution. You know, it is that final technical requirement, number four, that has tripped up some well-meaning churches, and it has cost givers significant losses in tax deductions.
No, that's right. And I know many of our listeners may be listening to the podcast here on the go, in the car, and not just ready to kind of jot down all those notes. Just to mention, we do have some samples, you know, that include that, all of those different items on our website at ecfa.org. And that really brings us to our fifth deadly sin, forgetting to disclose when givers benefit. And we're going to use a fancy Latin term, quid pro quo. So in these cases, if a giver receives something of value from the church when making their contribution, which is common, right? Often books or resources or meals, only the portion of the gift that exceeds the fair market value of the benefit may be deductible. In those cases, churches must provide a receipt for all transaction where the giver makes a payment to the church of more than $75. So it's a different threshold than what we mentioned earlier in the case of quid pro quo. Anytime there is a payment to a church of more than $75 and the giver receives goods or services in return from the church other than intangible religious benefits or items of token value, those are really just kind of the exceptions to that rule.
All right, for sin number six, we have estimating the value of non-monetary gifts for donors. In other words, a church becoming an appraiser. For monetary gifts, such as currency, check, credit card, the church should simply include the dollar amount on the giver's receipt. When it comes to non-monetary gifts of property, sometimes also called non-cash gifts, the church should only provide a legal description of the property and not the amount. So what we have is a tension that often surrounds a significant gift of property because the giver may request that the church value the gift, even documenting an excessively high value on the receipt. However, it's wise for the church to remain impartial in the matter and simply acknowledge the property by description and condition and not value it.
No, that's an important one. Well, last but not least, we've gotten to number seven of our seven deadly sins, and that is timing, or in other words, missing the right window. I know we often say timing is everything, and that is certainly true in the context of gift receipts. Here, the law requires that receipts not only include all of the proper elements that we've been talking about, but also that they be provided to the giver in a timely manner. The technical requirement we know is contemporaneously. Really, the timing rules vary depending in part on the type of gift that's involved. But the basic point to remember is that the giver is going to need a receipt for substantiation purposes no later than the due date plus any extensions of their federal tax return or the date that the return is filed, whichever date is earlier. So that's very important in terms of timing. And don't expect mercy if the receipt is provided to the giver at a later date, even on an amended return. Many of those cases that we've talked about have really centered all around that timing issue.
That's right. Well, think of it. We made it through all seven. And so while in churches, we don't expect that tax deductions are the primary motivation for a giver making a contribution, it is our duty to help those who desire to be generous to be able to claim all the benefits under the law that are available to reward their generosity.
Right.
So Michael, with that summary of the seven deadly sins of gift acknowledgments, it's now time for some real life questions, right?
Exactly. And this is one of my favorite portions of the podcast here. And that's when we take questions from our listeners. And those can be sent to us at podcast@ecfa.org. So this is a real life question that we have received here at ECFA. And just read it for you. It says, our church has a single mom's ministry, and we ask for donations from the congregation from time to time to bless them around the holidays and Easter. One of the gifts that we ask for is $25 gift cards, so they can spend it on groceries and such. Since this is not cash, do we still offer a gift in kind donation or a non-cash gift receipt to the person who's donating the gift card? And do we still not place the dollar value on the receipt? Just one of those receipting issues that I'm coming across that I can't find a clear answer to yet. So here we have a question involving gift cards that are donated to churches, which would not be at all uncommon. You know, it's a really good question. And I think at first it might seem like the rules could get a little muddy, right? But the good news is it's not. So while there might be a stated amount on the gift cards themselves would be considered gifts of property, so non-cash gifts, not currency. And so in these cases, a non-cash gift acknowledgement should be provided without a dollar amount on the receipt, which is one of the elements, Dan, that you covered in terms of the seven deadly sins, is not putting a value on those non-cash gift acknowledgements. And I think really the practical side in terms of this question too is that even though there could be a dollar amount listed on the gift card as the church, you really wouldn't be in a position to know whether or not the card actually contained that value, right? So not being the retailer, we wouldn't know what the value actually is on the card. So really a non-cash gift acknowledgement is appropriate. So Dan, just want to see, I don't know if you have any additional thoughts on that question.
No, you've made some great points there, Michael. And so it's the responsibility of the donor to claim a deduction for gift cards. Just one other side note on gift cards. Many times people give gift cards to churches frequently. And so the question is, what do you do with those gift cards until they are used? Do you put them in in your assistant's desk drawer and as somebody needs a gift card, they're released from from an unlocked drawer? Probably not. It would be very helpful to establish internal controls over gift cards. Perhaps set up a spreadsheet that would show each individual gift card, perhaps an estimation, since we don't know how much is really on the gift cards, but an estimation of the value on the gift card, and then an indication of when and how and why that the gift card was used. And so there would be certain controls over the gift cards. So for our second question, Michael, when you verify that a donation was mailed in the correct year, do you keep the envelope, the mailing envelope, as a record or proof? The questioner says, we have typically verified and then thrown away the mailing envelopes that the check was received in. So technically, the substantiation burden falls on the donor, so there are no permanent record-keeping requirements for the ministry. So in addition to a church's normal record retention processes, if a church received a very large gift at year-end, or one in which the timing seemed questionable, it may be helpful to scan the envelope that the check was received in addition to the copy of the check, so there's a record that you relied upon in determining which year the gift was received. Well, while we're limited in our time on the podcast answering these questions, the great news is ECFA has some terrific resources that can help if your church is interested in more information on these issues. Tracy, can you tell us more?
Absolutely. And thanks so much, Dan. It has been a great discussion today on the podcast. And with a title like Seven Deadly Sins, I think we are all going to be watching and scrutinizing our gift acknowledgments just a little bit more closely. And yes, we do have a couple of great resources available right now on this topic. First of all, we have the free one-hour webinar on demand, Acknowledging and Reporting Contributions for Churches and Nonprofits, with Dan, Michael, and ECFA's Executive Vice President, John Van Drunen. This is always one of our most popular annual webinars, with well over 1,000 folks registered so far for the 2016 edition. You can listen to this webinar on demand anytime you choose, and dozens of other webinars, by going to ecfa.org/events. Next, we have Acknowledging and Reporting Cash Charitable Gifts. It's a brand new ebook from ECFA Press covering the most important rules that you need to know on charitable gift acknowledgments. It includes sample policies, gift acknowledgments, letters to givers and volunteers, and more. This ebook is available for just $9.95 at ecfa.org/ECFA Press. For any questions on these resources or for any other ways that we can serve your church, contact me at tracy@ecfa.org. Dan and Michael, it's back to you.
All right. Well, hey, thank you so much, Tracy. And as always, we want to close the podcast again with a reminder to email your questions to podcast@ecfa.org. We really enjoy taking those questions, Dan, and we're going to continue reserving time in future podcasts to answer the most pressing questions on these important topics related to church administration. Dan, I know you also have a quick word of encouragement for us as we continue to strive for God-honoring excellence in administering the resources of our churches, right?
Yes, Michael. And a scripture that comes to mind on today's topic is Luke 16:10. Whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with very much. You know, it's a familiar verse, but I think appropriate for a couple of reasons. First of all, while having the appropriate wording and details on a charitable gift acknowledgement may seem like very little to focus on in the grand scheme of things, I believe God is always watching to see if we're being faithful and excellent in the work He's called us to. Being faithful in the little opens up opportunities for God to promote us to even bigger things. And from the church's perspective, I think it's also a good reminder that when we're faithful and diligent with the givers God has blessed us with today, this simply opens the door to God blessing us with more to be faithful over in the future.
No, that's exactly right. And a familiar verse that has a good application to the topic that we talked about today. So it's that time that we had to bring the podcast to a close once again, but we hope you can join us next time for part one in a new series on tax and reporting issues made easy. Who doesn't want taxes to be made easy, right? So we're going to start with ministers' taxes made easy. This is really perfect as we gear up for tax season once again. So you won't want to miss it. Until next time, God bless you.